Ladies and gentlemen, welcome this evening to a Lowy Institute event here in Melbourne. I have colleagues down from Sydney. I'm based in Melbourne, so the Lowy Institute has a presence in Melbourne. And we're very pleased to be able to partner with the NGV to have these events on, which we have regularly. And tonight is an excellent chance for us to showcase what's, I think, one of our premier products from the Lowy Institute, the annual poll that we do on Australian attitudes towards the world. I was thinking about polls on the way in this evening. I bought my football tickets because I'm going to the football on Friday night. It only took me a couple of minutes to mention the football. And I got polled after I bought my tickets. You know, was I happy with the service? And I got polled as I bought a suit the other day after it. I got a message from the joint I'd bought it for because I had to give them my email address. You can't get out the door unless you give them some information about yourself. And I get polled, was I happy with the service? And I was thinking about how many polls that we get. And we're talking politics about people being poll-driven, but there's a lot to say about marketing and the way in which business is poll-driven. But we're going to look at something that's much more serious, much broader in scope. And I was a journalist for quite a few years, and I used to report on the Lowy Institute poll each year, and I used to really look forward to it because the great thing about a poll like this one is it's now in, Natasha will remind me, I think it's the 15th year that we've run it. And so with such a longitudinal over time, that chance to look at trends over time, it's not just a snapshot of the moment. You get a perspective of how attitudes have shifted and moved over time. And we've got lots that we can talk about. We've called this event The Way We Live Now, but it gives us a sense of the way we used to live as well. There's so much uncertainty in the world at present that we'll discuss, and we can discuss Australian attitudes on. There's the relationship between Australia's traditional ally, the United States, and its largest trading partner, China, which has been, again, a feature of intense news coverage in the last week with Gladys Liu, who's the local MP from down here in Melbourne. Four of Australia's top five trading partners are engaged in trade wars. We know all about the China-US trade war. I think it's fascinating to see what's happening between Japan and South Korea and the tensions between those two partners of Australia at present. But there are also threats at home. Australians remain very concerned about climate change, although that had fallen away for some years during what we might call the climate wars of Australian politics, but also terrorism, foreign interference. All these are seen as much greater threats and were polled as much greater threats in 2019 than in the past. So there's a lot for our political leaders to think about, and we've assembled here an excellent panel to help guide us through some of these issues for this evening. I mentioned Natasha Kassam, who's sitting next to me. Natasha's my colleague from the Lowy Institute. She's run the poll for us, done an excellent job for the last year, is formerly a diplomat, was based in Beijing and Honiara, and was an author of, this must have been a fun exercise, was an author of the 2017 Foreign Policy White Paper. I'm going to ask later which sections, Natasha. Greg Sheridan barely needs an introduction. He's a long-standing commentator on Australian foreign policy, foreign editor with The Australian newspaper. Thanks for coming, Greg. Danielle Chubb from Deakin University and a contributor on occasion to the Lowy Institute, which I'm very pleased about. Danielle is a lecturer at Deakin University, specialist on North Korea still, and is running a major project on attitudes towards defence and foreign policy over 50 years, I think. 70 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've robbed you. And David Ollison. David, thanks for joining us. David's from, I've got to get the name right now because I just noted the merger earlier, King Wood and Mellisons, was the former managing partner of King's Wood and Mellisons, and is now a consultant to the international law firm and a former chairman of the Australia-China Chamber of Commerce in Beijing and a new Colombo Plan business champion. I want to get started on the poll. We've got some... I should. That's a very good idea. Thank you. Yeah, my name's Dan Flitton, and I run the Institute's digital magazine. It's called The Interpreter. We publish daily opinion and analysis on international affairs. And yes, based in Melbourne, barrack for the Tigers.
That's all you need to know.
Natasha, if we could get you started. I mentioned China, and we've got some numbers that we might be able to show. There we go. Can you take us through some of these results and let us know how this relationship or attitudes towards this relationship have evolved in recent times?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's great to be in Melbourne. This year, I think the Lowy Institute poll's headline was definitely the way in which attitudes are changing towards China. And above you, you can see that headline result, which was only 32% of Australians trust China to do the right thing in world affairs. That's a staggering 20-point drop over the course of 1 year. And what we can see, I mean, some people might think this is a blip, but actually, basically every question that we asked about China this year in the poll had some kind of a drop in a negative sentiment. So, for example, you can see 77% of Australians say that Australia should do more to stand up to China's military activities, even if this involves economic costs. We have only 41% of Australians saying that they think that China's infrastructure investment projects are good for the region, and 79% of them saying that China's infrastructure investment projects are actually plans for their regional domination. And that's our way of referring to China's Belt and Road Initiative, which has not been received well in Australia, and Australia still hasn't signed up to. Another kind of striking figure on this of this kind is that only 27% of Australians say that we are doing enough to stand up to China on human rights. So that's the vast majority of people who still feel that Australia is not doing enough on human rights in China. And even on the economic front, obviously, last year, for example, more Australians said that China was the world's leading economic power. They said that China was much more of an economic partner than a military threat. But this year, we have 74% of Australians saying that we are too economically dependent on China. And I mean, I've been asked so many times in the last few months, what is causing this? And of course, there could be many different things. But I mean, here's a question. When was the last time you heard a good news story about China? What can you think of? I really had to rack my brains on this one. I even did some searches on popular news websites. I think, you know, a few months ago, Australian wine exports to China overtook French wine exports. That was the only thing I could find. But what have you been reading about? You've been reading about upwards of a million Uyghurs in Xinjiang. You've been reading about Australian Yang Hengjun, who's been accused of espionage. You're hearing about excluding Huawei. Just this week, allegedly, the Ministry of State Security orchestrated a cyber attack on our parliament. Every single day, I think we're hearing a new bad news story about China. You know, when we did our polling in March, the protests in Hong Kong hadn't even started. So as much as we can say that maybe this is a blip, maybe this is an issue in methodology, I'm not that surprised to see such a change in the data here. What started to me as a, you know, a high-profile story about and Australian politicians and their connections to business people who were receiving, potentially were representing the Chinese Communist Party when donating into politics in 2017, has evolved into this much bigger narrative, I think, that is dominating Australian headlines.
Lavender teddies, I reckon, is about the last positive story that I can...
Tasmania,
Just thinking about those lavender teddy bears that became extremely popular and made one particular Tasmanian company a lot of money.
I mean, I think that was, what, 5 years ago?
Yeah, it was when she visited, I think it was for G20 in 2014.
Right.
And there were photos of him with purple teddies. If you haven't seen those, that's probably your positive story. Go and have a look for purple teddies. Danielle, how do these results then sit, do you think, with historic trends of the views...
Yeah.
Views of China, both from an economic perspective, but also from a military threat type perspective, and the changing attitudes that we've seen towards foreign investment in Australia over a long time.
So to introduce, I guess, where I'm coming from, as Dan mentioned earlier, I've been involved. I'm a co-author on a book that's going to be coming out next year that's taken 70 years of opinion polling data in Australia and tried to, on defence, mostly defence and foreign policy issues, and tried to bring them together in one place. So this is really from the end of World War II. And so the major source of data for this are the Australian electoral surveys. The Australian electoral surveys, well, that's from the late 80s. So the Australian electoral surveys have been running out of ANU, I think, since the 1980s, and they run with the elections. So they take place at the elections, and we've just got new data out now from the 2019 ones. Before that, there were commercial polls, so Gallup and all those other kinds of polls you can think of. When it comes to the question of how Australians feel about China, there's kinds of two sets of data that we can look at to examine how the Australian public and how Australian attitudes towards China have changed over time. And I'll go through some of this data in a minute. Go through some of this data in a second. So the first set of data, it tracks the perception that China could represent a military threat to Australia in the future. So is a potential military threat. So the Australian Electoral Survey has been asking questions about this since 1987, and Lowy, as you see, has been asking questions about this since 2009, I think. The second set is concerned with the role of China as an economic power, and particularly with its level of investment in Australia. So while we've got good longitudinal and reliable public opinion on how Australians feel about China as a threat, the evidence on how Australians feel about the level of investment in Australia is relatively new, as the issue is a newer one. We've only got a few years' worth of data on that, but I'll touch on it briefly because it does provide kind of a concise view of how Australians feel about this. So if we look here, you can see, can we go back to the military threat one? Sorry. You can see here that over this time frame, since kind of the late 1960s, how Australians feel about China has kind of changed dramatically. And I'll get to the 2019 result in a moment. This has been done mostly every 3 years. And then when Lowy came in, it was done every year from there. In the late 1960s, Australia was seen as the major military threat to Australia. Around one in three Australians saw China as very likely to present a military threat to Australia. And of course, this coincided with the height of the Vietnam War. So Australia and China were literally at war with each other. China was supporting the North Vietnamese in their reunification efforts against Australia, the US and South Vietnam. And so perceptions in Australia around threat that China could pose to the region and to Australia itself and the threat of communism was very high. And so about one in three Australians saw China as its military threat. And it was such a significant result that double the amount of Australians pinpointed as China as the major military threat in the late 1960s, as did Indonesia. So twice the number of people thought that Australia was, that China was more of a threat than Indonesia. And then as the Vietnam War ended, perceptions towards China gradually became less concerned. Australians became less concerned about China, as you can see, and it got round to about 2% in the mid-1980s. And around this time, Indonesia overtook Australia as the country that Australians were more concerned about. But then Tiananmen Square happened, and that's where you see this jump again. So around this time, you see that people's perceptions of China as a military threat, in response really to how China was cracking down on pro-democracy protesters in China, that translated directly into how Australians saw China as a threat and the kind of power it might be in the region. But it didn't go nearly as high as it went in the late 1960s. You got to about, I've got it written here so I'm not making things up, to about 18% as at its worst in the 1990s, and it went down again. And then since about 2000 to 2016, concern about China, as China has become more economically powerful, has started to assert itself in the region economically and militarily, has climbed about 9% in about 18 years. And then this year, it jumped 11%, which is quite extraordinary. This is in the Australian electoral survey data. I want to stress that the Australian electoral survey, Laurie didn't actually ask this question this year. I believe they'll ask it next year. But the question about China as a military threat in the Australian electoral survey, which was conducted at the time of the election, so again before Hong Kong took place, it asked the same question it's been asking for all these years. How likely is China to pose a military threat to Australia? And 29% of Australians said very likely. It jumped from 18% to, I think it was 18% to 29%, so 11% jump, which is, even though that's a preliminary data, we don't expect that to change more than 1 or 2%, and the data on every other country as a perceived threat has stayed about the same. So it's a significant threat. And as you can see, I think why this graph is so interesting is that you can see that Australians are driven largely by reactions to external events. But I also think it's really interesting that while at the time of Tiananmen Square, Australians were, you know, pretty concerned, they weren't nearly as concerned as they are now. Levels are up again around Vietnam War levels. So it'll be interesting to see. And I do think, and I'll finish on this point, and I can talk more about the investment question later if anyone's got any questions. But I do think that what's happening in Hong Kong right now will continue to influence how Australians feel about China, no doubt, because people are watching quite closely.
Yeah, and we'll continue to. That's fascinating, and a fascinating graph. I'm going to bring Greg in a moment because I want to bring in the other great and powerful country, the great and powerful friend for Australia and the United States. But just before I do, David, can I ask you from a perspective of someone who's worked with the business community, does this sentiment that you see on the screen, does that reflect the attitudes, do you think, within the business community? And Natasha mentioned, for instance, some scepticism about the Belt and Road Initiative. Mm. And is that something that you've seen reflected in your interactions in terms of a difference between, if there is a difference, between public opinion and business community opinion, if I can put it that way?
Well, I wasn't surprised to see a drop in the sentiment broadly in terms of, you know, Australian business sentiment, Australian sentiment towards China. What did surprise me on that first slide we saw there was that very dramatic drop. And it surprised me because it doesn't connect with what I'm seeing in the business world. You know, we're living in a world now where the Australia-China relationship at an economic and business level is as strong as it has ever been. You know, we have $180 billion worth of two-way trade in 2018. Now, that is compared to $80 or $70 billion with the United States and $70 billion approximately with Japan. So China is almost $40 billion a year more than our next two economic partners. So at a business level, we're engaging, we're doing business. And that translates in terms of good news stories. So if you're an exporter of commodities, iron ore or coal, you're actually laughing. So if you're a shareholder of a major Australian company that's in that business, you're doing very well, and so you should be very pleased with yourself. If you're an exporter of wine, you're doing very well. Last year, 2018, the value of exports of Australian wine to China grew by 20% in value, not only in volume. So that's remarkable, and that's largely driven by the reduction of tariffs as a result of the free trade agreement that Australia's negotiated with China, which is actually the envy of the world. If you're a service provider, particularly a small enterprise or medium enterprise service provider, whether you're an environmental engineering firm or an urban design firm, an accounting firm, even a law firm like myself, you're actually doing very well in China at the moment because we've got the services that China wants that taps into their evolving economy as they transform their economy from an export-led type economy to one which is more service-oriented and one which is underpinned by a growing domestic consumer market. So at a business level, an economic level, there's a lot of very productive work going on. And, you know, while we're on surveys, you know, there was another survey conducted, in fact, late last year, but the results came out earlier this year by the Australian Chamber of Commerce in Shanghai in conjunction with Westpac. It was their annual business sentiment survey of the members of AusCham on the ground in China. So that's an organisation that probably has around about sort of 500 or 600 Australian companies that are as its membership. And I have some figures here which are sort of completely different to what we're seeing up on the screen here. In this last year, 72% of businesses were optimistic about their China operations for this coming year. So at the end of last year, 72% of all Australian companies on the ground that did this survey were very positive about 2019. And that's even in the context of what was going on at the time. But what's more interesting is that when they were asked to their view of their sense of optimism or otherwise about the Chinese economy and their prospects for the next 5 years, 81% were very positive or positive. So that's a remarkable difference in sentiment for people that are on the ground. So I think the point that comes out of this is that while the broad business sentiment is understandable, the broad sort of sentiment is understandable, all the things that Natasha's pointed out, all the concerns that we have about security, influence and all of that, they resonate right across the board community. But at a business level, we're still engaging, and it's just a reflection of the fact that we have a very deep economic and business relationship with China.
Mm. Danielle mentioned earlier we'll take questions from the audience, so these are terrific things that we can dive into more, but I do want to broaden our discussion a little bit. And Kerry Stokes was on the front page of your newspaper, Greg, talking about last week, talking about the Morrison government reaching out more to China. You've written previously that you think we should avoid a binary that sees Australia as trapped between its biggest trade partner and its security partner. Prime Minister Morrison's en route now to Washington, but he's had no invitation to Beijing just yet. How do you think that Australia is doing to manage these two relationships, and do you think that that gets reflected in this opinion polling?
Well, Dan and Natasha and colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for inviting me here. The Lowy Institute is a fabulous organisation, does a wonderful service to the nation with this poll because it provides us from some data. I will later, if I get the chance, talk to you a little bit about the limits of polling in international affairs, because typically international affairs issues are not the top of people's minds, so often you're just asking, what did you see on the TV yesterday? You've got to be very, very careful with international issues polls. Mark Latham, when he was opposition leader, thought George W. Bush is very unpopular, the war in Iraq is very unpopular, Australian deployment in Iraq is very unpopular, so I'll oppose it. But these things that he saw were all true, but they conflicted with a much deeper commitment which the Australian public had to the utility and importance of the United States alliance. And once he convinced the public that he was a danger to the US alliance, his fortunes dived. And Alexander Downer and John Howard are absolutely convinced that was a critical moment, that his political fortunes dived. So I just issue a general caution about polling on international affairs. Very interested in David's comments. It shows the absolute disconnect between the business community and the strategic community. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I want businessmen and women to do business. I don't really want them to do strategy. I want strategic people to do strategy. I don't really want them to do business. You'd be mad to take any strategic guidance from a businessman. That would just be crackers. The idea that you'd let Kerry Stokes within a million miles of a National Security Committee of Cabinet. I remember I was at a business conference a few years ago, and all the jokers on the platform, you know, nice people, I shouldn't call them jokers, Jamie Packer, Colin Barnett, Kerry Stokes, were all saying, oh, gosh, we've mismanaged the relationship with China. What fools we are. We are uniquely foolish and dopey to cause all this trouble with our wonderful customer. James Packer, for whom I have great respect, even said at that occasion, we should be telling China how grateful we are that they're customers of ours. And, of course, I asked the simple question, so what is it then that has led Japan, South Korea, Singapore, Indonesia, the Philippines, and every other nation you care to mention, Germany, the United States, to have exactly the same troubles as us? Are they all also equally foolish and stupid and have mismanaged? Or could it be that there's something on the Chinese side which is troublesome? Now, of course, public opinion reflects the reality of what China has been doing the last few years. It's occupied an area greater than the Mediterranean in the South China Sea, where it has no legal right to do so, where all of Australia's trade, not all of it, but a huge proportion goes through. It's militarised all these islands, having promised that it would never do so. It's put a million Uyghurs in concentration camps. It's smashed religious movements in China. It's imprisoned every human rights lawyer that you could ever find in China. There are no human rights lawyers in China anymore. and it's engaged in massive cyber attacks, intellectual property theft, and a few other, well, what a surprise. The public has noticed. How surprising. And it affects their attitude. Now, the good old businessman is saying, oh, well, that's as may be. What's a million Uyghurs between friends? You know, that's okay. My exports are going well. And actually, that's what I want business folks to do, more or less, as long as they're not complicit in actual human rights abuses themselves. How have we gone between China and the US? I think we've managed things very well. The binary between China is our economic interests, America is our security interests, is a false binary. The Morrison government, in briefing for the Prime Minister's trip to the US, has said, and it's undoubtedly true, the biggest economic relationship that Australia has is with the United States. There are $1.2 trillion of two-way investment between the United States and Australia. Now, investment is an infinitely more intimate relationship than bulk commodities trade. When you invest in another nation, and the United States is the number one destination of our foreign investment and the number one source of foreign investment into Australia, when you invest into a foreign nation, you are saying, I believe in your commercial and legal regime. I am willing to put my assets and my people under the rule of your law because I know it'll be done fairly and I'll get a fair shake. On the whole, we don't do that much in China. Now, our trade with China is dominated by bulk commodities, tourists and students, and we make a lot of money out of it. That's great. I don't see how any Australian government could have done more trade with China. In fact, I think it is a problem that too much of our trade is with China, and we need to diversify our trade. That's why it was so important that the Adani mine be approved in Queensland. And it, what a magnificent populist revolt that was. Only Australian could produce a populist revolt in favour of Asian investment in Australian resources by India. Now, I don't think the good voters of Queensland had China uppermost in their mind, but certainly the desire to diversify our trade is proper. Now, I think, I'll finish on this, Dan. I think we've always been well led strategically, with probably the exception of the 1930s. We've made lots of individual mistakes, but I'd say going back at least to Alfred Deakin, going back even to Federation. Federation itself, the act of Federation was an act of national security, and China was in the minds of the people who led Federation. The act of Alfred Deakin in founding a navy and trying to pull the Americans into the region, very strong in his mind, was Japan's military power. Now, I think the long haul of Australian strategic history from then to today has been essentially a continuity, a continuum. I think we went to sleep in the 1930s and we've made lots of individual mistakes. It was stupid to lease the port of Darwin to a Chinese entity and so forth. But on the whole, I think we've been very well led. Now, it may become more difficult in the future, but if it becomes more difficult, that will be because of the actions of Beijing. And guess what? We can't control those actions. Even if we are led by a combination of Machiavelli and Richelieu and every great statesman in history, Australia can't determine what Beijing does. So I think so far we've done incredibly well. The prospects are we'll continue to do well. But Beijing's arc, its direction of strategic and political and social development over the last, well, ever since Xi Jinping became the boss, is very concerning.
I spent some time with the press gallery up in Canberra, and I remember quite well that both sides of politics would, someone from both sides of politics would often say that there was innate wisdom in the Australian people. And that's when they were referring, of course, to elections that they won. But that's the point in all of this, and that's part of what we're trying to draw out when we look at these sorts of polling issues. Greg's hinted at some fascinating deeper trends and bigger issues in all of this. I want to bring it back to the individuals. Let's just talk about Donald Trump for a second. Natasha, can you tell us a little bit about how Australians view the alliance with the United States on that point that Greg's making about the enduring and larger commitment that Australians have shown over many, many years but also the attitudes towards the man that's sitting in the Oval Office right at this moment?
Well, it's not going to shock anybody that Australians are not a big fan of Donald Trump. I think we saw that coming. You might be, I don't know, surprised one way or the other to know that only 25% of Australians have confidence in Donald Trump to do the right thing in world affairs, so a quarter. That puts him just above Vladimir Putin, just below Xi Jinping. So it's not necessarily the best company. And, you know, for our high watermark, Jacinda Ardern sits at 88%. So, yeah, a quarter of Australians have confidence in Donald Trump. I think what is perhaps more interesting, and going back to what Greg has said, is that Australians are firmly committed to the alliance with the United States. This has persisted despite unpopular administrations. We do see some wavering. So right now, 72% of Australians think that the alliance is important for Australia's security. That is lower than the 80s when during the Obama years, but higher than the Bush years, for context. And two-thirds of Australians, 66%, think that Donald Trump has weakened the alliance with the United States. But what I do think is really interesting is if you look at this chart here, have a look at that, the age breakdowns. So something that I'm finding really interesting is that in many issues in polling, we see younger people are perhaps a little bit more idealistic, and through their lifetime as they get older, they become more conservative. It's fairly normal in Australia. But this is actually new, where we have young Australians have even less trust in the United States right now than they do in China. So we talked before about how low trust has gotten in China, but 18 to 29-year-olds trust the United States even less. So when I say 52% of Australians trust the United States to do the right thing in the world, that's being very much held up by people over 60, perhaps people who remember the Cold War, who really rely on those security alliances. Now, it's still kind of early to say, I think, how we're faring in terms of younger generations and their views towards the alliance. But I do think that we may start to see emerging this idea that older Australians who definitely still do not like President Trump see him as an aberration in the US system. I think it's possible that young Australians think that something fundamentally has changed in the United States. And it'll be really interesting to see how that bears out in our next few years of polling.
I'll be fascinated to see whether Donald Trump asks Scott Morrison about Alexander Downer while they're on their trip together, and to see whether or not Mr. Downer's name came up as being the man that supposedly started the witch hunt and was the one that dobbed in the Trump advisor for spilling the secrets about Hillary's emails. Danielle, I mentioned Russian interference in the US election as a joke, but interference in Australia, the perception of interference within Australia, particularly from China, has been a very big issue for the last couple of years. What else is it that Australians feel threatened by when we look at these polls?
So do we have the graph on investment?
Investment, yes.
So we've been asking, the Lowy poll's been asking the question about whether or not what the level of investment from China, how they feel about the level of foreign investment in Australia. I think that there is a lot of, and I think Greg alluded to this, there is a lot of misperception. I think, anecdotally, I teach foreign policy to undergraduates, and they are shocked to hear that the US is by far the largest foreign investor in Australia. They all think that China is because of the media attention. So that's something to keep in mind, I think, when looking at this data, that there's a heightened concern. It's just like with the aid data, people think that we spend, tens of percents of our budget on foreign aid when we spend under 1%. But in any case, so when it comes to China, people's perceptions are wrong. But this question, and the 2019 data is not in there, it's changed a little bit. It's 4% down for too much investment and 4% up for about right, but it hasn't changed very much. But what's interesting, I think, is that while around 3/4 of Australians in 2018 believed that there was too much investment in Australia, at that time only 9% of Australians or 18%. Sorry, I have the actual number here, so I'll get it for you. So I'm not, yes. Less than one in five saw China as a serious military threat. So that was in 2018. So you had fewer than one in five, about 18% seeing China as a serious military threat, yet three quarters of Australians thought there was too much foreign investment in Australia. So people are able to hold these two ideas in their mind, I think, separately. And even now with this huge jump in the concern about China as a military threat and a slight decline in concern about the level of foreign investment, you've still got about two-thirds of Australian thinking that there's too much foreign investment from China in Australia, and around one-third concerned about the military threat. So there's about still a lot more people are concerned about the investment. So what does that tell us? I think it tells us that Australians appreciate and Australian politicians. In fact, I think Tony Abbott said it best off the cuff and perhaps by accident when he told Angela Merkel that Australians are caught between fear and greed when it comes to China. Our economy is so reliant. Our resource-rich economy is so reliant on China's economic growth. We know that. Australians know that. And yet we are worried about what that means for Australia.
I was just going to say the other major fear that comes in the data is in a way also related to China, which is its burgeoning economy and the effect that it has on the environment.
Yes,
and the way in which climate change has again shot to the top of this list of concerns. So I was going to ask Greg about the climate change issue, and if it's the top ranked threat to Australia in the 2019 poll, what happens to the government's climate policies? What happened then to the climate election that we've supposedly had?
Well, Dan, this is really a wonderful forum, and I'm learning so much from what the other folks are saying. And nothing is wasted on someone who writes as many columns as I do. You'll see all the other panelists' insights, and you'll think, God, that guy's making an unusual amount of sense today. But I thought I heard that from someone else. What about climate change, and what about our alliance? You see, if support for our alliance is dropping with young people, and that is a cohort effect rather than an age effect, that's a real problem. And that's where this Lowy research is tremendously valuable. So you have to interpret it. It's a bit like a Roman Catholic view of the Bible. You can't read it raw. You need some authoritative interpretation, you know? And if that is a trend that's emerging, that's important. Although, I think when push comes to shove in a security sense, people run back to the United States in the way they run back to a policeman, you know? And it would only take about 1 second of national security stress for everybody from every age group to discover that they love the United States after all. On climate change, now, as I say, I have the greatest respect for the Lowy poll. This is a really valuable piece of information. But look at the real world. So we had a climate election. Overwhelmingly, climate change is the number one issue according to the poll. So what happened in Queensland? Didn't they get the memo? Look at the Yellow Vest movement in France. No population in the world is more exposed to climate change kind of earnest do-goodery and everything than the Parisian population. No population is more avant-garde-ish about EU climate directives and all the rest of it. Emmanuel Macron raises the petrol price a speck in order to reduce emissions, and the whole of Paris goes up in flames. The hundreds of thousands of honest Parisians, mainly burghers, mainly not radicalised Islamic youth or anything like that, are turning over cars and setting fire to the city, and Macron immediately says, oh, sorry, I was just joking. No, I'm taking back that. Now, let's look at the reality of climate change. China is responsible for 28% or something of global emissions. It's increasing its emissions every year. It says it'll keep increasing until 2030. Its increase every year is more than our total emissions all up. Australians have a lot of common sense about this. So my sense is that they generally think climate change is a serious issue and want us to do something about it, but they don't want to bugger the economy or deindustrialise. In reality, a great many things that rich countries do about climate change are foolish or counterproductive. The biggest producer of coal in the world is China. The biggest user of coal in the world is China. Chinese and Indonesian coal are typically much more greenhouse gas emissions than Australian coal. They don't have the same thermal quality. So if you wanted to reduce emissions, what you would do is get behind the Australian coal industry and seek to displace Indonesian and Chinese coal with Australian coal. Similarly, if you move a manufacturing industry from Europe or Australia to China, or to most parts of Asia, where there are far less stringent environmental regulations, you will increase global emissions, not reduce them. Now, in a vague kind of way, Australians understand all this. So in Queensland, they're offered a choice. Now, I thought Bill Shorten's a very good bloke, and I didn't criticise him during the election because I thought on national security, he was fine. So my remit was not climate change, it was national security. I thought Bill Shorten, Richard Miles, Penny Wong were perfectly reliable on national security. So I'm not an anti-Labor jihadist. But the voters of Queensland were presented with, we're going to cut climate emissions in half by 2050 on one side, and the other side saying, what Australia needs is new and better and more coal mines. And how did they vote? They voted for the coal mines. Now, that doesn't mean the poll is worthless, but it does sort of place a reality check. And the final thought I'll offer you is I first got involved in the whole climate change debate because as foreign editor, I spent a lot of my time in Asia, and the Gillard government had a whole lot of government institutions telling us that everyone in the world was adopting carbon taxes and emissions trading schemes and all the rest of it. And anyone who spends any time in Asia knows that that's complete baloney. I was with a group of Australian journalists. We were talking to the Indonesian environment minister, and they were all saying, so when are you going to impose a carbon tax? They didn't seem to know that Indonesia has fuel subsidies. They pay you good money to burn carbon, you know. So a carbon tax, they'd have to remove their subsidies first. And really, the Gillard government was having a lend of the Australian people. It was baloney what they were saying. Now, I think people fill out these poll forms. They're not much concerned with these issues. They'll sort of say what's ever been in the news in the last couple of weeks. They'll also give a good, virtuous answer. I am, yes, deeply, profoundly concerned. I am moved at a human level by climate change. Then you say, okay, we're going to take $50 a month off you. They say, no, I'm not that moved. So I think the climate change result is the one I'd take with the greatest pinch of salt of all. Here we have a coalition government elected for a third term after decapitating prime ministers in successive terms, riven by division and put back into office by a pro-coal vote. That makes me just treat the climate change result of this survey with a pinch of salt.
So I think Greg's going to be offering for sale in Fitzroy a sort of buy Australian coal bumper stickers. I can see them. It's going to take off. I'm going to get questions from the audience in a second. Natasha, you just want to jump in. I also want to draw in David on one more thing. So if you can think about a few questions, we'll have a few minutes for questions.
Yeah, look, I know we don't have a lot of time, but just a few things that I wanted to point out. One is that when we talk about, for example, China's emissions last year going up by all Australia's emissions combined, we should also remember that while China's economy is slowing, it grew last year by the size of Australia's entire economy, right? So let's keep things relative. Let's also point out that China introduced an emissions trading scheme in 2017 and is investing more in renewable energy than any other country in the world by a dramatic effect. So,
I apologise for interrupting, but can I ask these two questions? How much of the economy does the emissions trading scheme cover, and what is the price of carbon under it?
I don't know the answers to that at the
moment. It covers almost none of the economy, and the price is nominal.
Right, but what about their investments in renewables? And they are world leading, and I just think it's important to highlight some of those things. I think it's also, people are worried about what changes will mean for them in terms of the economy and in terms of their wages. That's a very understandable concern. If you're in Queensland and you're going to be affected by a mining job, I can completely understand that. But to me, that's an issue of political communication and leadership, and in terms of demonstrating what the risks are and the ways in which our economy and our people are going to be nimble enough to change. Having said all of that, as much as we talk about Julia Gillard and carbon tax, I think it's often forgotten by that side of politics that in 2007 we had an election where both sides of government, John Howard and Kevin Rudd, brought an emissions trading scheme to an election. That was 12 years ago. And so I just think,
And won by a landslide.
Yes, exactly.
And couldn't deliver.
Exactly.
David, do you want to jump in on this issue? I have another question, but I'm also conscious.
Had a couple of observations.
Yeah.
But Greg made the comment about business keeping away from
strategic
issues. obviously, one of the big issues that's sort of changing everything at the moment now is what we call geoeconomics, you know, the intersection between geography, economics, and politics. In the past, we've been pretty good at a business level of keeping the security side of things separate from the business and economic dimension of business. You know, we've left security to be run by government, security forces to deal with that. Business just gets on, as you said, Greg, with doing business. But now there's that real intersection. You know, if you're a coal exporter to China and your coal is sitting on the wharf in China and you can't get it through for very uncertain reasons, but you know there's a major dispute going on with Australia at the time, you start to understand what all this means. You know, business is now being directly affected by security defence issues, things that are totally outside of the control of most businesses, and certainly things that boards of major public companies have not been well versed in trying to understand. So I think, while that's the distinction has been true in the past, I think we're moving to a situation where business won't be able to operate as successfully and profitably in the future unless it has a greater connection and understanding of those, you know, defence and security type issues. So I won't be saying we're going to be pushing into that space, but it's a deeper understanding. The other just a general observation around investment into Australia, Chinese investment, I'll be very interested to see the results of the survey in the next couple of years, because we have responded at a political level to that investment. You know, we've got the new critical infrastructure review process with FIRB. There's far more scrutiny of all foreign investment, but particularly Chinese state-owned investment into Australian businesses and projects. So that's already playing out. You know, I'm a lawyer. I see this on a daily basis. The number of transactions that we're involved with has dropped significantly. The value of those deals has dropped as well. So I think over the next couple of years, we'll get a sense that from a public perception point of view, this is not as big an issue, because there just won't be as many big issues. There won't be many land bridge investments into, you know, Ports of Darwin type transactions or major infrastructure investments. So how that plays out and what will be interesting in the years ahead.
Ladies and gentlemen, if I can ask if anybody's got any questions, if they pop their hand up, we've got a microphone that my colleague Jen will bring to you just to help with the hearing, just in the front here. If you could keep questions short, that would be helpful.
Yeah, good evening. Many of us, when we travel, are a bit surprised how Australia is perceived as a very racist country, and I'm wondering if there's any evidence from your survey that whether those racist attitudes that we sort of don't believe we have, but everyone sees we do have, whether that's playing into these results at all?
Well, that's an interesting question. So what we do ask about is how Australians feel about immigration and how we feel about our country as a multicultural one. The vast majority of Australians say that they feel that our status as a multicultural nation is important to who we are, important to our identity. Having said that, half of Australians think that we have too much immigration. There was a big spike last year. It's come down a little bit to 47%, but 47% of Australians think the government is allowing too many people into the country. The other thing that I think is quite interesting is that the numbers of people who think, for example, that migrants are a burden on the economy or on social welfare or are taking jobs, that is still a minority position in Australia, but more people are moving into that camp. It's up to about 40% on both of those. So there is something of a disconnect where you have 75% of Australians saying that immigration is good for our country, it's important to our identity, we should be open to the world, but then you have this sizable minority of people who are concerned about the effect of immigration on our on the economy and on jobs and welfare. We don't ask questions specifically about race, but I do think, certainly from my personal experience having lived overseas, that people often associate Australian history with our present. People talk about the White Australia policy. I get asked about it all the time, even though it was finished before I was born. You know, I certainly find people often overseas will say how I, as somebody who's from an ethnic minority but was born in Australia, am received here, and they're quite surprised when I talk about how multicultural and open the country is. So I've certainly had that experience as well. Some of the data shows some hesitation about that, but overwhelmingly, Australians are positive about our multiculturalism.
Does anyone have anything further?
Yeah. First of all, thanks very much for a fantastic forum so far. Like Greg, I've learned a lot, but starting from a low base. I've had a bit of experience in tertiary education in Australia over many years, and for me, one of the most dramatic changes has been the huge increase in foreign students, particularly from Asia. A lot of people who work or have worked in the industry often confide in their concern that this Asian invasion in academia has led to a massive fall in standards. And you get a lot of anecdotal evidence to say that we've got to pass these students because they've paid good money and there's enormous pressure to get them through. Is this just me being racist, or is there some evidence that in fact this has happened and a lot of university vice chancellors are not even deflecting it away from what I think is a major concern?
I'd say terms like invasion are pejorative, for sure. But Dan, you're in the industry.
I work in the tertiary sector. I teach in an arts degree. I can tell you that most Asian parents do not encourage their children to enrol in arts degrees. So I do not have a large number of Asian students in my classes. And when I do, they're highly motivated and do very well. And certainly there's no dropping of standards. I would find it surprising if that was the case. I think academics take their jobs very seriously. I can't definitively give an answer, though, because my own direct experience is not in the economics or the IT industry or any of those. And I think they're the areas where overseas students are coming. Certainly, the government is not. The government will say they're investing record numbers into education in Australia. That is only because numbers of students are going up. And so the amount of students they're funding through HECS to go to universities is going up. But Australian government investment into tertiary education in Australia has dropped dramatically, especially over the last 10 years. And that is why Australian universities are so reliant on international students. They would like not to be so reliant on international students because, I mean, China is building universities and soon they're going to stop coming. It's not good for Australian universities from that perspective, from a purely economic. And so I think that's my two cents on.
Looking at it slightly differently, Greg, do you think that the government takes seriously the risk that China could, say, turn the tap off on the students as a way of punishing Australia? I've seen that sort of thing talked about, mentioned.
Yeah, they should take that risk seriously. I agree with Danielle. I think it's just overdone. It's fabulous to have foreign students, absolutely fabulous. But I do think there's a real problem with standards, just as you outline, a real problem. Not because the kids aren't bright or motivated, but because they often don't speak English. And there is also a big problem with the universities becoming too reliant on it. Peter Varghese, on behalf of the G8, made that point the other day, and he said, as universities, we're aware that we're over-reliant on the Chinese market. And then thirdly, I'd say we have not given a good pastoral experience to many of these students. I mean, the idea is they should come into classes and we all should be in the class together and we should all get to know each other. Often that's not the experience. But Dan, if I can take a tremendous indulgence, just come back to the earlier question,
yeah.
I promise you I'll be very brief. I don't believe Australia is a racist country at all. Not at all. I would say we're among the least racist country on earth. Let me play my own bit of identity politics. I have a non-Anglo wife, three non-Anglo sons, non-Anglo daughters-in-law, non-Anglo grandkids, and they do not suffer racism every day. That is just ridiculous. And we have the highest number of overseas-born people of any OECD country of our size. We have an astoundingly diverse range of ethnicities in Australia. We have run a racially non-discriminatory immigration program for 30 or 40 years, and we have transformed ourselves from the land of white Australia when I was a kid to now a land where there are 1.5 million Australians with some Chinese ancestry and more than 1 million Australians with some Indian ancestry, and there's not been one speck of unrest about it. I also don't think we're seen as racist overseas. I just don't think that's true. I've just spent 3 months doing a fellowship at King's College London. And I tell you, the most positive brand you can have in the UK is Australia. I was staying somewhere not far from Hammersmith, and I'd walk down every day past the Antipode coffee shop. Now, their coffee, we don't grow coffee. They had no connection with the Antipodes, but it was just a good name. Foster's beer, which you can't get in Australia anymore, is everywhere in England because it's the Aussie beer. The most popular restaurant chain in Amsterdam is the Drover's Dog. It was absolutely full of... Australia is a fantastic name. In America, I remember being in Hawaii during the Iraq War, and somebody heard my Australian accent and said, I just want to come over and shake your hand. You're a great ally of America. We Americans love you. Now, what I think you're responding to is a view in the New York Times and The Guardian and those folks, those woke folks, the bien pensant woke folks, often fertilised by Australian woke journalists stringing for them. I mean, I remember reading a story in a paper once about the savage New York Times denunciation of Australia, and it turned out the joker making the point had written the article himself for the New York Times, and I'd written an article in the same week for the Wall Street Journal saying how great Australia was. So I could go...
My kids have had it pubs in England and places.
Yeah, yeah, so
it's
you...
pretty normal, I thought.
Yeah, yeah. No, well, that's absurd. Most people don't think that. Yeah, yeah, but most people don't think that. There's no evidence of it at all. It's particularly, and just to wind up on this, it's particularly the case in Asia, because everyone in Southeast Asia has a relative who lives in Australia. Now, would they all want to come here if they thought the place was racist? And, of course, because they have such personal connections in Australia, they know the reality, which is that it's not racist. They come here for the rule of law and the opportunity. So I think this is a typical sort of new class invention which has no basis in reality.
Thank you. A quick comment and a question. My experience of working in Singapore for a couple of years was actually the only politician that ordinary Singaporeans knew about was Pauline Hanson, and I was commonly asked about her and the perception of Australia being a racist country as an anecdote.
There was a spike under Hanson. Absolutely right. Absolutely.
This was actually... 2012 to 2014. Mm. My question is actually about higher education and the difference in perception and the way that we talk about our resources industry and our services industries. There is very little concern about China being a major customer for coal, for iron ore. That was generally seen as a very positive thing. However, when we talk about international education, even though in terms of a contribution to our economy, it's bigger than coal in terms of exports, there is such concern about international students, about international education revenue, and I wonder whether that is whether the higher education sector is the only area where strategic concerns interact with our get the better of maybe our economic interest.
One question to ask you before someone responds, just to ask you, please hold on the microphone. Could you tell me a single Asian nation, including Singapore, which has a racially non-discriminatory large immigration program?
Oh, no, not at all. And I'm not saying that there is no racism in Singapore. There's actually a large amount of racism in Singapore. It was more the perception that many Singaporeans had of me, including Singaporean family members of my brother-in-law, that we are actually a racist country. That was purely it.
Just on the question itself, David, can I ask if you want to have a first bite on that? And perhaps, you know, this is also a good segue into a question we didn't get to talk about in our discussion, which is around whether or not Australia is too, the perception that Australia is too economically dependent on China. It's one of the numbers that comes through quite strongly in the poll. Almost three quarters, I think that Australia is too economically dependent on China.
Well, I think just address that point to start off with. You know, obviously, I'm very conscious of the fact we've got this enormous relationship with China, but, you know, by any analysis, it's not good for us in the long term. And as you were just alluding to, you know, we've got concerns about, you know, what happens when China turns off the tap. It just can be a policy decision because of something that we've done, something that the United States has done, that we've sided with them, whatever, it's out of our control. They can stop tourists, they can stop their students coming down here, you know, they can add more behind the barriers type customs duties and things that stop, you know, our industry as a whole. So I think there's no industry or sector that's really unaffected by potential China risks and that might arise. You know, so I think that inevitably leads to the comment, well, we need to be diversifying our markets. And that's something that certainly our government's been working very hard at trying to promote. There's the work that's been done around the ASEAN nations in particular is an area that we need to spend more time on. At the moment, I think we're still a little bit blinkered at a business level. We still think of China as the place to go to because that's where all the effort has been put through free trade agreements and you know, just policy guidance and leadership. We haven't yet had a sufficient sort of cohort of Australian companies sort of actively engaging in other parts of Asia, which are the growth areas. And I think that has to be the next stage of our economic development and business relationship development.
I'm going to wrap this up shortly, yeah. But Dan, you want to
jump in? I might
jump in
just because if I understand your question correctly, you were saying, why is it that we know that Australia is very reliant from a resource perspective on China, and yet people aren't really concerned about that. We're like, I think it's a great thing. Oh my God, what are we going to do if China stops buying our resources? And yet, yes, our tertiary education system is propped up by Chinese students, and no one is saying, oh my God, what are we going to do when the Chinese students stop coming? They're going, oh my God, there are too many Chinese students. This has to stop. Is that, yeah. And I think that's really interesting. And why is that? What is the difference? What is the difference? Is it a race question? Is it a fear about China question? Is it about having actual people in our country? I mean, as someone who works in tertiary education system, Chinese students bring a lot to the Australian university system. And so why is it, I think, it's an interesting question to ask, that Australians are not that concerned about how heavily dependent we are on the resources. So it's actually, except that we're worried about the China's economy might slow down, but there's so much media attention and so much public concern about the influx of Chinese students into our universities.
Do you want to?
I was just going to say, you know, as a theory, I do think that's really interesting, but we are seeing in regard to the relationship with China some level of economic logic being replaced by security logic. There's very little security risk in selling a lot of things into another market. I think there is probably more perceived risk in having people from that country come here. I don't think it is about racism. I think it would be the same if it was any other country. And just on the kind of polling side of things, one reason I think that you see for example, business sentiment in Australia is still very high when it comes to China, but in the United States, it's very low, right? The United States business is, I mean, not necessarily behind tariffs, but behind this new hard on China approach that we're seeing out of the administration there. The reason for that is that I think, personally, Australia's relationship economically with China is very complementary. We sell them things. We don't really have a lot of boots on the ground. Whereas the United States, it's different. It's, for one reason, it's much more competitive, but they have American businesses in China who are worried about their intellectual property, who are worried about the forced technology transfers. And so a theory would be that it's about that security risk that doesn't come from selling things.
I think between this debate about foreign interference in our research sector and foreign interference in... Yeah, I think that the higher education debate gets confused, I think, sometimes.
It's a pity. We could go all night.
Yes.
And I'd love to. I'm conscious I've got to let you... A lot of you probably go home for dinner and the like. It's one of the rules of the Lowy Institute that we're supposed to finish on time. We've run a little bit over time. I'll get in trouble for that.
4 minutes.
I mentioned at the outset that we are over-polled as a country. There is a small poll that I'll get you to do at the end of this. If you could just all tick that I did well and that we finished on time. No, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming this evening. I'm really thrilled to have the opportunity to host a Lowy Institute event here in Melbourne for us to talk about these big issues. I'd like you to join with me in thanking the panel.
Thank you.
Very, very, very grateful to my four colleagues for allowing us some of their time to come out and to talk about these issues. We'll be having more Lowy events in Melbourne and look out for them. And also the poll information, all the poll data is freely available on our website, and you can go and you can download it from there and you can dive into these issues with abandon. Thanks very much.